This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
I really do define us as luxury, and for me, I don't think luxury these days is necessarily about the price tag. It's more about the experience. With needle and thread product, you're getting something that's so bespoke and so much craftsmanship and so much care and attention in the product that women just feel so good in the brand.
In this series, I talk to people who are at the top of the creative industries about their work and their relationship to luxury. And today my guest is Hannah Coffin from Needle and Thread. This is a brand usually described as ultra-feminine, vintage-inspired women's wear with an emphasis on hand detailing. It's affordable luxury worn by everyone from Jessica Alba to Dame Helen Mirren. And I have to say, Hannah, you are the living embodiment of your brand today because you're sitting opposite me in this lovely sort of deep cream-coloured, rather nostalgic ruffled blouse. But you've got a pair of tight jeans and then lacy ankle boots, which I don't think I've ever seen before.
Well, yeah, I don't dress like this every day. I've been to a board meeting this morning, so I'm a bit smarter. Some days is, you know, jeans and T-shirts. Other days is dresses and trainers. It depends, you know, what's on, where I'm going, what I need to get done that day.
So tell me a bit about when your love of fashion and things, clothing began. I think you were brought up in the country, weren't you, in Gloucestershire?
I was. I had a really rural upbringing, and my love affair with textiles started really, really young. I come from a very big family, and my Nana basically started to teach me to sew and knit and do all these other creative things when I was very little. So, you know, 5-6 years old, I was learning to embroider, obviously with much bigger needles and, you know, really basic stab stitches. And it got more and more sophisticated as I got a bit older. I think looking back, it was probably just a way to keep me quiet, just to keep me busy, you know, tucked away in the corner doing something for the afternoon. But it really left an impression on me. My dad is also incredibly creative. I just grew up in a very, very creative family. And
creative, what, painting, creative?
Just everything. It was quite, I suppose, quite a lot of pressure actually to kind of keep up with it. And I suppose it was inevitable that I would end up being a creative person. So my love of fashion really began through textiles, through embroidery, through knitting. And that's something that's really carried through into my brand, Needle and Thread, interestingly. My love affair with garments themselves started when I was about 11, when I was given this sewing machine for Christmas, and it was an old Singer one. It was not even a plug-in electric one. We're talking like really old school. Like
with the pedal.
Yeah, with a pedal and a
hand.
I know. But actually, it was a really good way to learn to sew, because you couldn't go that fast actually, because you had to like wind it up by hand. So in terms of, you know, sewing through your fingers and all the kind of errors that you can do on the machines, the electric ones in the early days, wasn't so high risk. I started making myself clothes, and I mean, when I look back, it's a bit cringy. The most awful smocks that I used to wear with leggings and, you know, DM boots. I mean, oh, honestly, thank goodness Instagram wasn't around in the 90s, I tell you. So I sort of learned all the seams, how to construct garments. I would make my own patterns. You know, if I could see the garments now, they're probably shocking, like the most awful, like wonky seams and whatever. But, you know, because I started so young, by the time I was sort of 13, 14, I'd become more and more confident. I'd been given an electric, you know, machine. I was like, woo, I could go a bit faster, you know. So it was just really fun.
So who was encouraging you with all of this? And was it entirely driven by your desire to have new outfits yourself? Or did you feel sort of compelled on a larger canvas, as it were? You making things for your mum?
It was largely for myself, you know, and for friends, I would say, and my little sister, poor thing. I think what she looked like with anything I made. But it was mainly for myself and friends. And I don't really know, you know, where this calling came from. Maybe I just felt that it was something I could own in a very creative family where, you know, my dad was very good at this and my grandfather was very good at this, and making clothes was something that I could own and be really, you know, good at.
But then you went on to study fashion, didn't you?
I did. So I studied at Ravensbourne. I studied fashion and textiles, and it was the most amazing 3 years. Absolutely loved it. It was just this textile heaven. So it was, you know, it was a very sort of messy hands-on degree. And my collection was just it was just so fun. Like, even now I look back at the work I did then, and of course, you know, the slightly older version of me cringes a little bit and think, oh, I could polish that up a little bit. Of course, you know, we get better with age, I suppose. But the essence, the freedom, the creativity, the use of colour, the engineered patterns, are all the elements actually that have turned up in Needle and Thread. So it's really fun.
But how did that sort of hands-on ability to make things translate itself when you then started working in the fashion business? Because actually, there's not very many people working in the fashion business who can actually make anything.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting, isn't it? I think it gives you a fast understanding of how to make a 2D sketch into a 3D garment. I think it just enables you to be a more considered designer and have the ability to design clothes that are ultimately commercial, wearable, and that your consumer will really enjoy wearing.
You left college.
Yeah.
And you immediately got a job.
I did. I was very lucky. I was introduced to the head of design at Karen Millen, and I had an interview. So I graduated on the Friday, and I actually started Karen Millen on the Monday. So I sort of had these great plans of, you know, having a bit of a summer off, but, you know, this opportunity came up, and I decided that, you know, I didn't want to miss out. And I was at Karen Millen for 3 years, and I was very fortunate in the people that I was surrounded by there. There were a lot of very skilled people. So of course I turned up thinking, oh, you know, I've got my degree and I know how to design. And of course, by lunchtime on my first day, I decided that, you know, perhaps I didn't know everything I thought I knew and needed to kind of knuckle down and just sort of watch and learn, which is what I did for the next 3 years.
Do you think actually it would help at college if you were taught the sort of business side of things as well as the creative side of things? Because, I mean, there's very few people, I suppose, coming out of those colleges who are not going to have to deal at some level with the business side of things, you know, no matter how much of a brilliant designer they might be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head there. I think that as much as my degree was just this pure creative mess, heaven, I really loved it, it would have been really useful, even if just one term was dedicated to business, to how to cost up a garment, how to do pattern lays, how to pitch your brand, how, you know, just all these aspects that just don't come up in education.
You mentioned working at Karen Millen, then when you left there, you went to All Saints, and All Saints, in a way, you reinvented their whole look, because at the time they were very sort of grungy rock and roll, weren't they? Everything was sort of black or grey.
Yeah.
And they've become a much broader outward looking, you know, fashion range, haven't they?
Exactly. So during my time at All Saints, I was the design director, and I just had the most phenomenal design team. And I'm still in touch with all of them. In fact, lots of them still work for me at Needle and Thread, and they were just so talented. And we just had a, you know, really, really good run at evolving that product from what was essentially menswear shrunken down into womenswear. But we, with the team, really created a feminine handwriting that suited the DNA of the brand, that the consumer responded really well to. It was a good time.
And were you already at that time sucking up knowledge? Like, did you already know that the next stage was going to be out on your own?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I always knew that from about the age of about 11-ish, you know, it was this, I know I keep going back to the sewing machine, but it's something, you know, it just really struck something in me. And from there, I just, you know, as a child, I really wanted a brand. Of course, I didn't have a clue what that actually meant at that age, you know. In fact, a few years ago when I launched it, I don't think I really knew. I don't think I really knew what I was getting myself in for, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, that was always the plan. And I was very lucky during my time at All Saints that I was mentored by some very generous people. And I'm still in touch with a lot of the other directors there who are on my speed dial if I need anything. So I was very exposed to the business aspects at the time.
So when you started Needle and Thread,
yes.
What was your conception for it? What was it? Had you established that there was a gap in the market, or was it a passion project in terms of what you wanted to design? What was sort of inspiring you at that point?
What was inspiring me really was the the opportunity that I could see in the market space, rewind, you know, 5 or 6 years, the contemporary sector was much smaller. There really wasn't a destination for a brand that I wanted to go to as a consumer and buy dresses from that I could wear to events or, you know, family celebrations or just going out with friends. I really struggled with that part of my wardrobe.
Dressing up.
Yeah, yeah. And just, you know, something a bit special, you know, when you're just going somewhere and you just want to feel good about yourself and you just, you know, you just want to look a certain way. And I just couldn't find it. And I just had this thing in my head where I thought, look, if I'm struggling with this, then I wonder if other women are also struggling to find this. So I just wanted to deliver product that I wanted to buy, I wanted to wear. And fortunately, lots of other women have agreed and, you know, have come along on the journey with us.
For the people listening who've never seen, and I know they can go on, you know, yeah, a search engine and, yeah, and press images and see them, but describe what a needle and thread dress looks like, quintessential needle and thread dress.
Okay, so we specialise in surface decoration. So a needle and thread dress is likely going to be embroidered or embellished. So they're very special. They have a lot of love and attention to them. They have lace trims. It's very, very feminine in a time when I think brands are sometimes afraid to be truly feminine. You know, it's just something that I've really embraced. It's what I really, really wanted to bring to the market. You know, we work in pastel colours through to black, but the styling is very contemporary. They're very easy to wear. They're very beautiful and they're very timeless.
You're not that compelled by seasonal changes, are you?
No.
And that actually is one of the unique things about needle and thread.
Yeah.
You sort of have drops a few times a year, yeah, rather than launching spring and summer and so on. Why have you gone about it that way? Because it's sort of anti-fashion, but actually it seems to be very much actually how young people are shopping now.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think times are changing. I like to design and deliver product at the time where I think women want to buy it, you know, so...
Isn't it? Because I wonder where that ever came from, because you always find, you know, just at the time you're about to set off on holiday and you desperately need a bikini and a pair of sandals, you know, everyone, there's winter coats in the shop windows and you're thinking, how did that happen? Why did that happen now?
I know. The entire industry just sort of needs to be shifted slightly in terms of the deliveries. And to your point about trend and timeless, we really value designing and manufacturing timeless product. And I think in a world where sustainability is becoming more and more important to our values, I don't want to be delivering fast fashion. We want to be delivering garments that can stand the test of time, that you can pull out of your wardrobe in another 5 years. It's still going to suit you. It's still relevant. It's still going to look good when you go to that event. And that's really important to us.
How do you manage, you know, because you also make them for affordable amounts of money. Mm. You know, we're not talking about thousands of pounds for an awful lot of the things you make. We're sort of talking between 200 and 800.
Yeah.
Benchmark. So how do you manage to do that? Because along with, you know, sustainability and everything, there's a lot of conversations about how workers are treated and, you know, your stuff's made in India.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk me through a bit of that.
It's largely process driven internally, so I won't bore you in all the sort of nooks and crannies, but essentially we're a volume brand, so we manufacture a lot, and like anything in life, when you manufacture in more volume, it's better for the supplier, it's better for the brand. And we really focus on minimum wastage in the brand. We don't design things that don't go to production. And we work very, very closely with our suppliers. We partner with them. We don't really see them as factories. We see them as partners. We partner with them on the garment costs, and we sort of dissect the costs with them and make sure that we're doing everything as efficiently as possible.
If you're a volume brand, how do you make sure that my special dress, my special occasion, isn't being worn by somebody else at my special occasion?
Yeah, well, I know. So our global reach is huge. So when I say that we're manufacturing volume, that's spread across the world. So, you know, north of 20% of our business is in the Middle East, north of 10% is in the US. So the spread is is kind of secure enough that you're not going to turn up in the same dress with somebody.
You started out sort of with big ambition and I think about 4 years in had a little bit of a curveball thrown at you. Talk me a bit through what happened there and how you survived that.
So I founded the brand and, you know, and that was literally going to Mac, buying a laptop, hiring one person here, hiring another person in India. I spent about 60% of the first year in India and about 30% of the second year in India. So, you know, it was really, really full on. At the same time, I was doing a lot of big scale consultancy work to essentially fund the growth of the brand. So the brand got to a point where I was earning through consultancy and putting it into the business. And that's great. And I think it works to a point where you can get proof of concept that, okay, this is working, we've got traction. And then eventually I think you need to make a decision. And I got to a point where I needed to make a decision and decided to get some investment into the brand in order to really start some serious growth.
But there must have been a moment where you thought, because you went into receivership, didn't you? There must have been a moment where you thought, this has all gone belly up.
Yeah.
This is my dream.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't like to go through that again, put it that way. It was quite a tough time, but you fight for it. And, you know, lots of businesses in the early stages go through trauma like that because it's really, really hard. It's really, really hard to start a brand up and get it successfully, you know, out of the waters and onto dry land, as it were. Yeah,
and a lot of people, I mean, I think the thing that a lot of people are afraid of is having happened to them exactly what happened to you. And yet you've managed to surmount it and carry on and thrive.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there are specific things about you that you think have made you, are you particularly resilient? Why are you so resilient? You know,
oh my goodness.
What did you think in the worst part of that process of having to try and put money into the company to stop it from sinking?
Oh, probably just being really stubborn, I think, you know, just not wanting to fail and believing in something so much that I knew it would be all right eventually, you know.
Did you?
Yeah, I did, deep down. And don't get me wrong, it was a challenging time. But I'd go in and, you know, look at my team and just think, no, this can't be the end. This, you know, there has to be another chapter.
Tell me a bit about traveling in India, because you spent an awful lot of time there.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about that experience.
Well, I mean, I've been traveling to India for years in my career, and I added it up one time. I think I've been there over 120 times. But in all honesty, I've just seen a lot of factories. So I have done sightseeing on the side, but I've spent a lot of time in the supply chain over the years.
Where do you go the most?
Delhi. So our head office and our supply chain is in and around Delhi. And I would sit on the embroidery beds with this, like the master sari beaders, with the design team out there. So, you know, my role in the beginning was, you know, very hands-on, very creative. And since obviously the business is so big now, I've got this amazing design team in India and in London. But at the time, in the early days, that's what I was doing. I was choosing sequins. I was looking at embroidery threads. I was drawing. I was, you know, it's actually amazing. I really miss that. I know. And I'm really jealous of the team when they get to do all that, you know.
So what, I mean, India's a particular sensory overload. I don't think you've been necessarily impacted by the colour schemes there, because an awful lot of what you design is very pastel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not so much strong in the colours. But an awful lot of the designs and patterns look like you might have picked them up on your journeys, you know, everything from kind of, you know, birds and flowers.
Exactly.
And, you know,
It's a real hybrid, actually. So we design the research that we do as a brand is very British. We spend a lot of time in lace museums in the north of England, or we go to Portobello Vintage Market. And those are all the things that I sort of tag along to, you know.
Very important that you're there.
Very important business meetings, you know, vintage shopping in Kent. So I love doing all that still with the girls. So a lot of the research is traditional British costume, you know, 1800s prints and illustrations and things like that. But absolutely, there's this accent of India that just naturally comes in because we have all the textiles developed with our team there. So, like the hummingbirds or dragonflies or butterflies, you know, they sort of creep in, and it's a real collaboration between the territories.
And was the move into bridal wear a kind of really obvious one, because you're already making those sort of ultra feminine dresses that an awful lot of women nowadays only wear on their wedding day.
Yeah, yeah. It was so obvious. It was staring at me in the face, actually. At the time, I was just dipping in and out of the customer care emails. And, you know, I think as a CEO, as a founder, you sort of do sort of dip in and out, just sort of check, get read the temperature of what's going on in various functions. And I would sort of dip in and out of the customer emails. And it was just email after email after email saying, you know, does this come in white? Can I have this in white? Can you add sleeves onto this? I'm getting married in June. Can you do this? And I thought, gosh, what a really obvious opportunity, you know? So we designed a gorgeous bridal collection and it performed incredibly well.
Would you describe yourself as a luxury brand?
And I if really so, would. Yeah.
What defines the luxury in your brand?
Yeah, I really do define us as luxury. And for me, I don't think luxury these days is necessarily about the price tag. It's more about the experience, I think. With needle and thread product, you're getting so much, something that's so bespoke and so much craftsmanship and so much care and attention in the product that women just feel so good in the brand. And when you look at one of our dresses and you actually really study what's in it, you know, the lace motifs and the florals and the thread colour balance and everything, it's just, it's so pure and it's so creative. Being able to bring that to market at the prices, you know, to your point earlier, so it's accessible, so everyone can touch and experience that, I'm really proud of that.
How do you think you're seen by, I wouldn't say so much rivals, but, you know, if you're making a product that's so sensational and so beautifully made and, mm-hmm. you know, the attention to detail and everything, but there are people out there who are selling something similar that's had a few zeros on the end of the price. Mm. So do you think that you're taken seriously as a sort of fashion rival, or do you think that you're treated as a sort of anomalous brand, like, it's odd that it's working?
I think there's a certain level of curiosity around how it's working. I get asked a lot, you know. I think there's definitely curiosity. The brands that do add perhaps a zero or two on the price have also acknowledged that, you know, we are in the space and we're not really going anywhere.
Are you surprised at yourself? Because you're sitting there, you're talking about the brand and, you know, you're speaking like any CEO. Mm. Are you surprised that the sort of little girl who liked to sit at the sewing machine has turned into this sort of uber glam, capable, modern, you know, successful woman?
Well, firstly, that's not how I see myself, but thank you very much. Yeah, I'm very, very surprised. I think my whole family are also a bit surprised, you know.
And what about the fact that you've now turned your beloved hobby into a business? You know, doesn't that leave a vacancy, as the saying goes?
Yeah, it really does, actually, because I can't do textiles for a hobby anymore. It is work. It becomes work. It's, if I tried, it would just bed into the collection somehow, you know. So I actually spend time doing calligraphy. I do origami as well. I recently picked up jigsaw puzzles, you know. I just keep trying all these other creative things. It's not quite filling the void, the love that I had of textiles, but that's as close as I've got so far.
And is that how you relax?
Yeah. Yeah, I find it quite mindful, just, you know, writing or, yeah, folding bits of paper. It just, you know, it just makes me, yeah, shut my mind off, I suppose, after such a busy day.
And so what's a luxury for you? You know, a lot of people come in here and they say time, you know, having time is a luxury. I know you've got a young child.
I have, yes. Yeah, it's. I did want to say time, but I know that that is just,
it.
I know, I'll try not to.
If I can't have it, you can't have it.
No, I know, exactly. Let's try and do something else then. You know, I think there's living a life of luxury and then something more tangible. So for me, living a life of luxury is about choice. It is about spending time with my son. It is, you know, those precious things that you can't buy that I really hold dear to me. But then in terms of something more product-based, I really value crafted product where, you know, these heritage crafts have been passed through generations. You know, that I think is amazing.
What still inspires you? I mean, where do you get your inspiration for you know, for your patterns, for your designs, for your where do you go out in the country to sit on a bench in a park?
Yeah, it can kind of come when you least expect it. There's definitely a floral obsession in the brand by myself, and I share it with the team. We are just obsessed with florals and laces. So a lot of our inspiration will come from garments from the 1850s, from illustrations from, you know, 1900. That is what I love. In the society that we're living now, there's just not the time to sit and draw, and that art is slightly lost, and I find that sad. So I think, you know, in some way we can bring some of that archive British skill back in a different way, in, you know, the needle and thread apparel way. But that's generally where our inspiration comes from.
Is there a woman who sort of embodies, you know, the ethos of needle and thread for you? I mean, you're not really uber associated with celebrity in the way that some brands just seem to be flashing their cash to own them. I mean, I know Helen Mirren's worn your dresses.
When we design, I suppose, and create a collection, I don't have a muse or a woman in mind. For me, it's much more inclusive than that. And it's really important that girls who are, you know, 18, 19, and they want to really sort of invest and, you know, mum, will you buy me this for my prom? That's as important to me as somebody in their, you know, 40s, 50s, wanting to go somewhere and feel really good. We've got a very sophisticated technical team. So when we cut the garments, we're very sensitive in terms of where the waist height is, having stretch lining to accommodate different body shapes. The length can be adjusted, you know, regardless of your size, the territory you live in or demographic. You know, that's not important to us. It's what's important is that it just fits everybody and everyone feels good in it.
I think you've brought me an item that you consider a luxury.
I have.
Today. I'm wondering what that might possibly be.
I know, I'm going to get this out. So what I've brought with me today.
She's opening her big black handbag.
I know, my business bag. This is like my working office. I've bought this little pot with me. It's a rosewood pot and it's got a silver lid on it. And my dad actually made this.
Oh, and he's handed
it down to me.
It's very beautifully made.
I know. Do you want to see it?
Yeah, I'd love to see it more closely.
So my dad
fits in the hand.
Yeah, exactly. My dad just, well, like most of my family, they can turn their hand to anything. So it's really, you know.
But this is probably, I mean, you'd expect to see this in sort of Asprey's.
I know.
In Harrods even.
Yeah, you would actually see that in Harrods. And I asked him last night how he made it, and he just sort of sent me this long message of this, you know, step by step how he made it with this soldering and, you know, lathing the wood and everything. And he's just so technical. And for me, that is, you know, pure craft product, and I will pass that down to my children.
It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah, it's a sort of hand-sized circular pot. The lid slides off the rosewood.
Yeah.
It's really beautifully done, really beautiful.
But the fact that, you know, my dad made it is very important.
If I let you loose in Harrods today, just go to any department you want, pick up anything you want, where would you go?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's just too much choice here, isn't there? It's insane. I think the jewellery edit here is just phenomenal, I have to say. I love the Indian jewellery they have here. They have all the rough-cut diamond jewellery, which is just absolutely gorgeous. I love that. I don't know. I would just be running around like a mad woman, I think. Yeah.
Thank you very much, indeed.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Hannah Coffin. Next week, I meet Tamara Ralph and Michael Russo, creators of the Haute Couture House of Ralph and Russo. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.